Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
I need somebody help, not just anybody.
Recording in progress.
You know I need someone help. When I was younger, so much younger.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host, where I want to use today to talk about JFK and to field questions you might have, where I'm going to encourage callers who have questions, something that's always bothered them about the assassination, to go ahead and call in to 540-352-4452. And when I see you're there, assuming it's an appropriate point, I will take your call and seek to field your question. Now, bear in mind, that doesn't mean I'm going to satisfy what you're looking for. Bruce from Texas was clearly not satisfied when I explained to him that Connally didn't say anything to Jackie. Now, Connally was shot in the back, at which point he blurted out, "My God, they're going to kill us all." That was the only statement Connally made. And while it's true that when you see in some frames of the film, he seemed to be turning and his mouth is agape, that's because he's reacting to the bullet that he's experienced in his back. Which appears to, by the way, have transited through his chest, shattered a rib, exited around his right nipple, gone into his right forearm, but then wound up in his left eye, if that was one bullet. Now, my own personal opinion is it was likely at least two, a shot to the back, and then a second that hit his right arm and may have been deflected into his left eye. But the point is, Bruce wasn't happy with that. So, you know, what can I tell you? I've been doing this for 30 years. I began in 1992 bringing together the best experts who've ever studied the assassination. A world authority on the human brain who is also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics, who's also an MD and board certified in radiation oncology, which is the treatment of cancer. Using x-ray therapy, so he's an expert in the interpretation of x-rays. A physician who was in trauma room number one when JFK's moribund body was brought in, and then 2 days later was responsible for the care and treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald. a legendary Pullman film analyst, another PhD in physics, this time with a specialty in electromagnetism, where he's an expert on the properties of light and images of moving objects, where he did a brilliant tutorial on internal features of the Zapruder film that demonstrate conclusively that it's been extensively altered. We know where it was altered, when it was altered, by whom it was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center. There's a 5-volume set about the Assassination Records Review Board and its efforts, you know, to depose key witnesses, accumulate key documents and all that, which was created by an act of Congress in order to, you know, get all the records out. And he was a senior analyst for military records. His name is Doug Horn. Volume 4 of his 5-volume Inside the Assassination Records Review Board is devoted to the Zapruder film, how the original was developed in Dallas on Saturday the 23rd at a Kodak film op. They made, I believe, actually, we're officially told there was the original in 3, but I believe there was an original in 4. Indeed, the first number of copies missing, and I believe it was sold to H.L. Hunt for $100,000. And then one of those was taken back to the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C., where one team went about analyzing it. It was an 8-millimeter all-ray split film where the Zapruder camera used a 16-millimeter film, but it would shoot down one side called the A side. Then you have to take it out, flip it over, and then shoot down the other side to get the B side. So if you wanted to show the whole thing, you'd have to splice the film up the middle and then, you know, cut it up the middle, split it, and then put it together. I used to do this when I was a projectionist in junior high school, you know, to create a single continuous. In any case, they didn't even have an 8-millimeter projector. So they had to have a shop owner open his store so they could purchase one so they could view it. And they prepared briefing boards of the key shots. Now, the following day, when a different crew was working, a Secret Service agent who identified himself as William Smith brought a 16-millimeter uncut version developed in Rochester at a secret CIA lab adjacent to Kodak headquarters there, known as Hawkeye Works. David Lifton was the very first to sort this out and to realize something had happened here and that there appeared to have been a switch. And they made another set of briefing boards. Well, Doug Horn's the guy who's the expert sorting all this out. In volume 4, if you want to get the details. But what this means is, while the original would have run around 1,000 frames, what we have today is only 487. Meaning more than half of the original frames, more than half of the original film is missing. Plus, they use the sophisticated techniques of optical printing and special effects in order to create exactly the version of the assassination they wanted. And they did that with a Zapruder, and then they used that as a guideline for other films, in particular for The Knicks, which was taken from the opposite side, from a greater distance away. So, assuming I get that far, I'm creating a video version of today's show, and you'll be able to hear all of this, but also watch the images. And you'll see, because I'll play a fair amount of the next film, which is going to be frustrating a bit because over the radio won't be able to see it. But where it's taken from the opposite side, and it turns out that when they did the editing, it was not flawless. I mean, so that in the next film, you can see Clint Hill, who rushes up to assist her. And by the way, I believe the only way he was able to rush up and assist Jackie is because both of the vehicles were at that point in time motionless. They were not moving. Officially, the vehicles ran like about 11 miles an hour, which is well below 30 miles an hour, which is supposed to be the minimum limit at which you transport a president of the United States to help secure his safety. But 11 miles an hour, I don't know anyone who can't run 11 miles an hour, right? I mean, you can run, we talk about, well, a four-minute mile. You could run 11 miles in an hour sprinting. But the point is, it looks as though Clint Hill was able to get up and push Jackie back because the limousines weren't even moving. Now, in the next film, you can see him actually making contact with Jackie, which is significant because in the Zapruder, you cannot. In the Zapruder, Clint Hill does not make contact with Jackie. So there you have an obvious glitch. They edited the Zapruder to make it come out the way they wanted, but it wasn't perfect. In comparison to the Knicks, there were a couple things that fell through the cracks. They didn't get just right. But John P. Costello, PhD, the guy with a PhD in electromagnetism, discovered from studying internal features of the film is that they had taken out the Stemmons Freeway sign, probably because it had a hole through it that was inconsistent with the official three-shot scenario. And when they put it back in, they put it in the wrong place. So that John's been able to identify, you know, we have photographs in the air where it was originally. And when you compare it with where it is in the film, it's not in the right place. Now, you might not think that's overly significant, but the fact of the matter is it's conclusive proof of editing. Where, believe it or not, there's some purported experts on JFK, and I would myself grant them that status, but they continue to insist the film is unedited, that is basically unaltered. One of those is Josiah Thompson, where at one point in time I thought he was Cat's Meow. I was a huge fan of Josiah Thompson. We would turn out to be adversaries as matters would emerge, because, you know, I organized in the first Zapruder film conference at the JFK Lancer in 1996, where I brought together, well, we had a workshop the day before, and I had about, oh, I don't know, a dozen experts, at least some of whom I'm convinced were plants. And then the following day, I picked the ones who were the best to give their presentation about evidence, you know, of alteration of the film. And it was very successful. But there are those who want to maintain the film is authentic, because if the film is altered, then, who in the world could have altered it? It was only hands in the Secret Service and the CIA. So it had to be the Secret Service and the CIA who altered it. It wouldn't have been possible for that to have been done by Lee Oswald or pro or anti-Castro Cubans or the KGB or the Mafia. How could they got their hands on the Zapruder film? In fact, one of the arguments Josiah Thompson sought to make to me, which was supposed to disprove the thesis that had been altered, was we have a chain of custody and it was always in the hands of the Secret Service or the National Photographic Interpretation Center. But that's this kind of act. The Secret Service were in on it. Among the my earlier contributions was actually sorting out how many different ways the Secret Service had been complicit in setting him up with a hit. Now, I'm just back on Twitter. I want everyone to know, at Jim Fetzer, I'm thrilled to be back on Twitter. And I think the timing's extremely good because there's a lot of developments, including, you know, I have the False Flags and Conspiracies Conference 2022 forthcoming. I have my petition for a rehearing before the Supreme Court. It'll be in conference on the 2nd, and I should learn on the 5th. So on the 2nd, it's being heard by the Supreme Court. If I get at least 4 votes, I should learn then on the 5th that they are issuing a writ of certiorari. And on the 3rd and the 4th, I'm moderating 26 presentations, 13 a day, about false flags and conspiracies. And then on Tuesday is my birthday. So what I'm hoping is that the Supreme Court is going to give me a nice present wrapped up with a bow. Now, Elon Musk, who opened this up and put me back on, has been challenged by others who said, look, you just let Fetzer on. Who, you know, why not let Alex Jones on? You just let Fetzer on. And he wrote the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. Well, I didn't write the book. I edited the book, but that's the right idea. And Musk actually tweeted back something about how Neil Heslin claimed he held his dying son in his arms. A point I've used to expose inherent inconsistencies in the official narrative, because Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, announced during his press conference, which many, if not all of you, have watched at one point or another, that the parents weren't even allowed to come into contact with their children. Well, if the parents weren't allowed to come into contact with their children, who were only identified on the basis of photographs, then how could Neil Heslin have held his son in his arms as he died? They cannot both be making truthful assertions. So if Neil Heslin held his son, then it's not true that the parents weren't allowed to come into contact with their children. And if it's true the parents weren't allowed to come into contact with their children, then Neil Heslin is lying about having held his son Jesse in his arms as he died. Well, while they cannot both be true, they can both be false. And what's most interesting is that in my petition for a rehearing before the Supreme Court, I have 2 appendices. Well, actually, there are a total of 5, A, B, C, D, which are bound together in the first set, and then Appendix E. And in the appendices A, B, C, D, B is the FEMA manual for the exercise. C is a Connecticut FEMA showing they had on their schedule the drill to be held at Sandy Hook Elementary School on 14 December 2012. That's pretty good stuff. But in Appendix E, I have a licensed private investigator who's gone into the Connecticut State Police photographic files and discovered a host of photographs that are inconsistent with the official account. For example, the photograph down a hallway where the principal, Don Hoffspring, is supposed to have died, and the school psychologist. There's supposed to be 2 bodies that are in pools of blood, but there are not only no bodies, there's not a speck of blood. And inside a classroom, not only are there no bodies, no blood, there are not even any desks, not any desks or chairs, no teacher desk, no chair, no American flag. In other words, he not only unearthed evidence that the official account was false, that no mass shooting had taken place, but that it wasn't even a functioning school. And that is now before the United States Supreme Court. So I tweeted back to Elon Musk, who'd been, you know, asked about having admitted me back onto Twitter, that he might want to check out, you know, what I have there in response to, you know, his having cited Neil Heslin's claim. In fact, what I did, I linked to an article about Alex Jones, because that's when I was, you know, bounced off of my blog. When it was taken was when the first Alex Jones trial began, and they were starting to slam me and others, where I was supposed to be the, you know, batshit crazy. But if anyone wanted to find out what that batshit crazy professor had to say, you couldn't do it because they'd taken the blog. I mean, that was all what it was for, what it was about. So I since I have the new blog and I have it there, I was able to link to an Alex Jones story and tie in. I mean, I'd be glad if Alex Jones came back. I'm ecstatic that Donald Trump is back. So the fact is that we're being played an awful lot, and I'm doing what I can to expose how we're being played. And with regard to JFK now, you have to understand so much of the evidence has been altered and manipulated, including the X-ray evidence, which is why David W. Mandic, MD, PhD, is so important. David and I first came into collaboration in 1992, where I had been dismayed by observing it would turn out to be the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association, colloquially known as JAMA, denouncing everyone who'd ever done serious research on the assassination. This was in the wake of the release of Oliver Stone's magisterial film JFK, which is by far the most accurate, complete, and comprehensive presentation of what actually happened at Dealey Plaza on 22 November 1963 ever presented to the American people through the mass media. Now, I mentioned that guy Robert Grodin, who also claims the film is authentic. So he didn't tell Oliver it had been massively edited when he made his film. He also didn't tell Oliver that Lee Oswald had been in the doorway. Indeed, this guy, Robert Grodin, had been hired as a special investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassinations when they redid the investigation in 77-78 to look into what were supposed to be rumors at the time. Rumors at the time that Lee had been in the doorway. And he did some research that involved fabrications and came back and said, yeah, that was just a rumor. It wasn't Lee in the doorway. Now, Robert turns about a big friend of Judith Vere Baker, who has quite an elaborate story that I take to be true of having had a romantic relationship with Lee Oswald in New Orleans the summer before he came to Dallas. She's written a book about it, Lee and Me. There's another book about her, Dr. Ferry's Monkey, because she and Lee and David Ferry and a doctor who would be killed were engaged in research to develop a rapid acting cancer in New Orleans using lab rats. And they appear to have succeeded. Indeed, it appears this was actually used on Jack Ruby to shut him up because Jack was a little too talkative. Well, the irony here is that Judith, even though she and Robert are good friends, actually proved that Robert's research was shoddy. Because Robert had taken they tried to palm off a guy who was wearing an elaborate checkered, black and white checkered shirt as having supposed to have been the man in the doorway when Lee Oswald was actually in the doorway in a different location, and he was wearing a very richly textured shirt that Marina recalled having laundered, by the way, back from Russia, kind of tattered and torn, but very, you know, tight weave, reddish. And what Grodin did was to take a black and white checkered shirt for this guy who looks like a Neanderthal, I call him Gorilla Man, and put it on Billy Lovelady. It was a version of the shirt. It wasn't the same, because one of them had a pocket and the other didn't have a pocket. So here got Grodin doing really gross fabrication of evidence. I really dislike this guy. We once had lunch together, by the way, in Des Moines, Iowa, where we had been invited to be two speakers to a group of high school students who were doing a whole class on JFK. And where while he and I alone had lunch together, he offered to let me use his two color photographs that are supposed to be from the autopsy, where he's got all this matted hair and other stuff. And I said to him, well, yeah, but they're fake. Robert Groton has done some good work. He did a co-authored book with Harry Livingstone, High Treason, or that was with Robert Modell. That was very good. He did a book, kind of a picture book, but with a lot of commentary, The Killing of a President. He did another book called The Search for JFK, which has a simply excellent section on the Tippit killing, where Lee is supposed to have shot J.D. Tippit, but it was all totally fabricated. Aquila Clemens, a black woman across the street, said 2 men had shot Tippit, and that neither of them looked like Lee Oswald. She got it exactly right. 2 shell casings that had been ejected from automatics were at the scene. 4 shell casings, 2 Remington ran 2 Western, you know, of different makes, which rather strongly suggests there were 2 different weapons involved. And the first officer on the scene initialed them. But as happened, where Tippit was shot 3 times in the torso, 1 of the bullets was deflected by his badge. And then when he was lying on the ground, he was shot in the right temple. But yet they laundered the evidence, so they changed. Lee Oswald had a revolver. A revolver does not eject shell casings. And it's absurd to think that Lee would have shot a police officer 4 times in an open the chamber to remove incriminating shell cartridges. Besides, those from a revolver are distinctly different. They're larger than those from automatic. So, I mean, this whole thing was a sham, so that now the alleged evidence does not have the first officer on the scene's initials. And the revolver cartridges, and I got 3 of 1 make and 1 of the other. I mean, this is such bullshit. They were not everyone involved in doing the cover-up here, just as not everyone involved in doing the Sandy Hook were rocket scientists, so they made certain mistakes. They even claimed to have found a wallet of Lee Oswald in the vicinity of where Tippit was shot. But Lee Oswald had a wallet on him when he was arrested. How many wallets do you carry? Back after this break.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
So let me return to some of the questions people have had about JFK that have bothered them. One is that Greer, the driver, shot JFK. Now, there are frames in the film where it looks as though Greer is turning back to JFK with a silver weapon in his hand. And it is, of course, the case that Secret Service agents are trained to fire with her left or with her right hand. But it's actually disprovable on the following most basic grounds. I mean, not only would have been a pretty stupid thing to do, I mean, so public and all. And I'll return to this question of why it was done in public, but not by the driver turning to issue Jack. The driver is to Jack's left front. So if the driver shot Jack, then his brains would blow out to the right rear. Now, this is looking at the limousine from behind, okay? The driver's to the left front. There's Jack. Fire him, brains blown out to the right rear. Instead, they were blown out to the left rear. We have a tremendous amount of proof, including that Officer Bobby Hargis, who is riding to the left rear, where there were two motorcycle escort officers on each side who had been instructed not to ride ahead of the rear wheels, which they thought was ridiculous, but where that was meant to ensure they wouldn't interfere with the shooters, with the multiple assassins taking their shots. Well, Hargis reported he was hit so hard with the debris that he initially thought he himself had been shot. I mean, this isn't open for debate. That means that Greer did not shoot JFK. This is actually a matter of physics. And if you go back and take another look, you'd see, well, given the distance of that weapon that Greer is supposed to be holding, he'd have to have an arm the length of a gorilla. In other words, his arm would have to be 50% longer, roughly, than a normal arm. And Greer had normal arms. And what we're actually seeing is a reflection of the head of Kellerman. Kellerman was partially bald, and we're seeing actually a reflection against his silver image. I mean, look, believe me, we have scrutinized all these ideas. Believe me. We're not. I mean, you know, you're entitled to hold your own opinion. I'm not asking anyone they need to accept what we have discovered. I'm just telling you, I put together the best group of students, the best experts to ever study the case, and I'm giving you a distillation of our findings. If you go to my books, you'll find it's not one book, meaning not a single authored book. My goodness, there might be 20 contributors to assassination science. I think there are a dozen contributors to murder in Dealey Plaza. There are 6 contributors to the great Zapruder film hoax. And then there are, I think, 17 JFK, who, how, and why, which I would publish, 14 years after the great Zapruder film hoax, bringing up to date some of our latest research. Now, so Greer shot Kellerman. Okay, it's, yes, we've entertained the hypothesis, and it has been falsified. Greer did not shoot JFK. On the other hand, there's no question whatsoever that Greer was in on it, because Greer was driving the vehicle. In fact, once they entered the kill zone, once they took that altered parade route, turning from Main Street onto Houston and then the 110-degree turn back onto Elm Street, which, by the way, in and of itself was a violation of Secret Service protocol. You're not supposed to make any turn greater than 90 degrees. And this has to do with the time of exposure of the presidency and taking turns like this. It's just too long. Just as I've already observed, you're not supposed to drive lower than 30 miles an hour, but they were said to be 11. And actually, Greer pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed. Where he'd already been hit twice, but not mortally, at least not to all appearance mortally. He was shot in the back, about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column, by a shot that was fairly shallow. Only went in about as far as a second knuckle on your little finger. From the top of the county records building by a deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford, using a .30-06 to implant a Mannlicher Carcano bullet. In other words, this was a bullet that had been fired from the weapon they were going to frame, use to frame Oswald, so it could be tracked back and said, yes, it came from that rifle. Look how clever this is. So you implant the bullet, and it's got the right rifling to be identified as having come from the Oswald weapon. Using a sabot, this is the Mannlicher Carcano is a smaller caliber than the .30-06. So he used a plastic collar known as a sabot. Jim Mars and I agreed on this 100%. Turned out that Sabot would eventually be in the position of a Black Panther whose home was raided by the FBI. And after the raid, the only thing that was missing was a Sabot. S-A-B-O-T spelling. But Jack had also already been hit by a bullet passed through the windshield, fired from inside the triple underpass by an Air Force expert, whom I believe had been given the weapon he used. It was a new version of which only a small number had been produced, but one of which was given to General Curtis LeMay, who is an extreme right-winger and anti-Kennedy guy, and I believe LeMay gave it to this Air Force expert by the name of Jack Lawrence, with the order to shoot the president. And then, you know, Lawrence knew this is coming from the chief of staff of the Air Force. So he would take it seriously and believe he was doing the right thing. You know, the chiefs had concluded Jack was a communist. I mean, this, you can't believe the happy horse shit that went into all of this. The CIA was upset because he was threatening to shatter it into 1,000 pieces for having misled him about the Bay of Pigs, which was all deliberate. It would turn out that the agency learned before the invasion that the Soviets knew we were coming, and the date, information they'd shared with Fidel Castro. So the Soviets knew, the CIA knew, Castro knew we were coming. He was prepared. He made quick work of the brigade at the Bay of Pigs. The guy who wasn't told, who wasn't notified, was a commander-in-chief. I have no doubt whatsoever he would have called it off. It was something he inherited, by the way. This was a Nixon thing. And George H.W. Bush appears to be the point man who orchestrated. It was codenamed Operation Zapata. The Bush family oil company, oil drilling company's name was Zapata. Two of the ships were rechristened before the invasion. One was rechristened Houston. Another was rechristened Barbara. I mean, that's what George H.W. Bush did in World War II. He christened his planes. He lost several of them. Barbara, after his wife. And he was given a report about the event afterwards. The CIA would try to deflect when his name appeared on it that this was another George Bush who was a file clerk, but he wouldn't have been receiving reports on operations. No, George H.W. Bush was a supervisor of the Bay of Pigs, even though he wasn't formally a part of the CIA. Indeed, when he was officially, publicly, he wasn't part of the CIA. So that when it emerged, you know, that a George Bush had received a copy, they claimed it was his file, correct? But it was just bullshit. Just a cover story. He was actually arrested coming out of the Daltex, where he supervised an anti-Castro Cuban who had an honest-to-God Manlicher Carcano, who fired an honest-to-God 3 shots from the window of a broom closet that was framed by the fire escape in the Daltex building of a uranium mining company that was a CIA asset. Chauncey Marvin Holt, who was a third of the 3 tramps, whom I got to know personally, explained to me how the CIA has all these proprietaries with innocuous sounding names. For example, he was working in relation to the assassination as a contract agent preparing 15 sets of Foreign Secret Service credentials at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store, which was like a 5-story building. The CIA ran its ID operation on the top 2 floors. They prepared the Alec Heidel, for example, for Lee use when he was in New Orleans. And the bottom 3 floors were actually a legitimate business. And get this, how beneficial could it be? The legitimate business was one manufacturing sheriff and police ID. So if the CIA needed a sheriff or police ID, they could get not just a fake badge, they could get a real one. So Chauncey was working at the instruction of his handler. His name was Philip Twombly, to prepare those 15 sets of Foreign Secret Service credentials. George H.W. Bush was actually in the Daltex supervising the anti-Castro Cuban, whose name was Nestor Tony Escadro, firing 3 shots with a Manlicher Carcano. Now, because the weapon is so unreliable, it was actually known as a humanitarian rifle in World War II for not actually harming anyone on purpose. Of the 3 shots fired, and this was virtually on the horizontal because Elm Street has a slight decline, an 11-degree slope, and he's on the 2nd floor, and it was virtually on the horizontal, yet he missed twice. One hit a distant curbing and injured a bystander by the name of James Tagg, which would eventually lead to the necessity to subtract one from the three shots that the FBI and the Secret Service concluded had been fired, since they were locked into three and only three shots, when it would later turn out that one of them had missed. They had to be very inventive, which led to the magic bullet theory, which all is a pile of crock. It's just a crock. The magic bullet actually was a bullet found by Sam Kinney, who is a driver of the Secret Service limousine, when they were cleaning up the car. I mean, you shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be washing blood and brains off the limousine, but they were doing that already in Parkland. That's a destruction of evidence. And there you had some bystanders who were observing this through and through hole in the windshield of one, a cop, actually stuck a pencil through it. We have a lot of witness reports about it. But he found this whole bullet, which has to have been the one from the back shot that worked its way out. The man, the Kirk-Carcano bullet implanted by Harry Weatherford, the deputy sheriff. And Sam Kinney took it in and left it on a stretcher. Well, let me just say, Oliver Stone, I think, you know, when he redid his, when he did this JFK Revisited, and it was released on the 22nd of November 2021, it was all about the magic bullet, but he doesn't even explain that Sam Kinney discovered the bullet in the limousine. I mean, that the whole story was hocus pocus. He doesn't even explain that David Mandy had taken a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions to JFK and plotted the official trajectory, which isn't even anatomically possible because cervical vertebrae intervene. So that Arlen Specter, and this is an observation of Mark Lane in his quite brilliant early book called Rush to Judgment, is a hypothetical question. When he was questioning Malcolm Perry, he'd actually perform a simple tracheostomy incision through the small, clean puncture wound that he described three times during the Parkland press conference as a wound of entry, that the bullet was coming at him. A transcript which was never provided to the Warren Commission because it would obviously have contradicted the three from above and behind storyline, where I included the Parkland press conference as well as the Bethesda autopsy report as well as a death certificate from Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician in Assassination Science, the first of this trilogy, that actually shattered the cover-up. And once you shatter the cover-up, once you discover the autopsy x-rays are altered, that it was evidence of a second shot to the head, that someone else's brain was substituted for that of JFK, that the Zapruder film was massively edited, none of those things can have been done by the usual suspects. None of those things could have been done by the mob. None of those things could have been done by pro- or anti-Castro Cubans. None of those things could have been done by the KGB. So you can just eliminate those alternative hypotheses from consideration. It had to be an inside job that involved complicity between the Secret Service and medical officers of the United States Navy who were engaged in altering the x-rays. Not everyone, by the way, involved in the autopsy and all that was a bad guy. I mean, there were a lot of Navy techs who were very honest and talk about their experience and how. Even Gerald Custer, who was a radiation tech, who actually took the x-rays, explained to me, and I shared it with David Mantic, how the testimony of this x-ray officer was on duty. He was an alternative. He wasn't the regular guy, but they put him in there by the name of Ebersol, John Ebersol. It just consists of one lie after another. And when I read the transcript, I knew there was something odd because he claimed to have graduated from the University of Indiana. Well, I had my PhD from Indiana University. There is no University of Indiana. It's Indiana University. In fact, graduates are very emphatic. It's IU, Indiana University. So when I'm reading here, Ebersol claimed to be from the University of Indiana, I knew that had to be fabricated, fake. So Gerald Custer just redlined the transcript of the testimony of the radiation officer, and the thing was a massive red, which I would share with David because he's the leading expert on the medical evidence in the world today. Has been basically from the beginning. After he began entering the National Archives, he'd been there 8, 9, or 10 times. He'd made all kinds of astonishing discoveries, including that none of the autopsy x-rays in the National Archives are original. None. Not one. And it was very convenient because Jack had been a naval officer that Bethesda Naval Hospital would have all of his x-rays. So Bob Livingston, the world authority on the human brain, who was also an expert on wound ballistics, would supervise an emergency medical hospital for injured Okinawans and Japanese prisoners of war during the Battle of Okinawa, among his other distinctions. Explained to me how the wound to the throat must have fragmented part going down into the right lung, where there was evidence of bruising, in part upward, where it severed the tentorium, which is a tough membrane that covers the cerebellum, which is a compact part of the brain at the base. And how was he forced to that inference? Well, we had physician after physician at Parkland Hospital describing through this fist-sized blowout at the back of the head cerebellar as well as cerebral tissue. Cerebral tissue is a gray matter. That's more the top of the largest mass of the brain, cerebral. Blown out, it would be kind of gray and maggoty looking. The cerebellum is a compact part of the brain right at the base. And it would have a more reddish hamburger-like character. So, I mean, it would be very difficult even for a first-year medical student to distinguish them. Well, we got 8, 9, 10 physicians experienced with gunshot wounds. I mean, Dallas was like the murder capital of the universe at the time. Reporting cerebellar as well as cerebral tissue extruding through the brain. Now, Bob observed to me, and it's in his report, which was published in my very first, The Assassination Science, 1998. That cerebellar tissue could not have been extruding unless a tentorium had been ruptured, that this membrane is very, very tough. And even the near simultaneous impact of multiple shots of the head would not have ruptured the tentorium. And therefore, cerebellar tissue would not have been extruding unless the tentorium had already been ruptured. And what was the only possible causal explanation? That the bullet that hit him in the back fragmented and a part went up to his brain and ruptured the tentorium. And from everything I can tell, JFK's reaction, because he's basically dormant, it's like, he's not paralyzed, but I wouldn't call it paralysis, but it's the equivalent behaviorally. He's not making any motion, any sound. He's kind of limp there. We do see in the film a reaction of his hands coming up to his throat, which I think would be pretty normal if you were hit in the throat. We also have Caliban saying when he was hit in the back that he cried out, "I'm hit." So I believe Bob's got it right, that there's no alternative explanation for the tentorium having been ruptured, in the absence of which there would have been no extruding cerebellum. So we're getting into some techniques of medicine here that require true expertise for their analysis. So that throat wound did occur prior to bringing the limousine to a halt, but it would have appeared superficially that the target might still be alive. So he had the umbrella man pumping an umbrella, the only umbrella in the whole motorcade route. He's pumping the umbrella, which is visible from all the shooting locations, which is really telling the shooters, keep firing. The target is still alive. So Greer pulls the limousine to the left and to a halt with a jostle. It's abrupt. Everyone is shot forward. And by the way, we have 3, 4, 5 parties with whom I've been in contact that have seen what appears to be the unedited film, and they all confirm the abrupt limo stop and that everyone's thrown forward. Well, you don't see that in the extant version of the Zapruder because that's such an obvious indication of complicity of the Secret Service in setting him up for the hit. I mean, they're only stopping to make sure the man will be killed. So he got that anti-Castro Cuban in the Dow tags, Nestor Tony Escadro, using a Mandlaker Carcano to fire 3 shots, one of which misses and injures, hits a curbing and injures a distant bystander. Another misses and hit the chrome strip over the windshield, the chrome strip around the windshield in the limousine. And the third gets Jack in the back of the head. Now, it was in the vicinity of that little bump on the back of your head, which is known technically as the external occipital protuberance. Now, if you were lying in a bathtub, it's where you'd be reclining your head if you were, lying in the tub. And the Bethesda physicians identified this location, and this David has confirmed that it was a location of the first hit to the head. So the limo's motionless. He's hit in the back of the head. Now he's wearing a corset. Jack Kennedy, as every student of PT 109 is aware, injured himself saving a fellow sailor when his PT boat was sunk in the Pacific. So he had to wear this kind of corset. It was a back brace, but it was cinched up very tight that day. And made him virtually a sitting duck. It meant he didn't have the ability to move around even if he wanted to. So we'll pick it up after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of a library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Okay, so Jack's been hit in the back. That's the first impact. Some dispute, but I'm inclined to think he probably did call out and say, I'm hit, just as Roy Kellerman observed. I mean, why would Kellerman make it up, even though he was involved? If you want to, you know, conceal your complicity, you want to go with as much truth as you possibly can. I think making that up would have been silly. So he says, I'm hit. Then he's shot in the throat by a bullet fired from inside the triple underpass by this Air Force guy. And thereafter, he can't speak. I mean, he's been shot in the throat. But the bullet fragments, part goes down into his right lung, part goes upward and through the brain and severs a tentorium. Because he is wrapped in this brace, he's not actually able to move. And while I believe his hands came up to his throat, and in fact, Bob Livingston, the World Authority on the Human Brain, said to me while we were flying to Dallas together, where he and David would present their findings, that was something known as a Thorburn reflex. Now, there are people out there who don't even think there is such a thing as a Thorburn reflex. And if you're shot, you know, in a way that hits your nervous system, your spinal column, that your arms will react in a certain way. And he said to me, it was a Thorburn reflex. Now, this guy's a world authority on the human brain. He founded the first department of neuroscience in the world at the University of California in San Diego. He's won virtually every award and form of recognition possible for a neuroscientist in the world. He was even a member of a group that will receive the Nobel Peace Prize. This guy is like the leading neuroscientist in the world. And if he's explained to me, and this was in 1993, that his hands went up as a function of the Thorburn reflex, and I have no ground whatsoever to dispute it. But he is basically also, you know, from this point on, non-responsive. I mean, I don't believe he's even conscious because his bullet has gone through his brain in order to sever the tentorium. So In my opinion, that may have been a fatal shot, but it wasn't obvious to external observers. And by the way, Thomas Evan Robinson, the mortician who prepared the body for a funeral, said, observed that there was no discoloration of the face and that he died instantly. And I think he was probably already dead. So Greer pulls the limousine to a halt. Everyone's jostled. Jack, because of this brace, sort of, and I would imagine Jackie probably assisted him, regains sort of sitting up, but he's just a sitting duck. Now he's hit in the back of the head by a shot fired by Escadro from the Deltecs. And he slumps, external occipital protuberance. He slumps forward. Jackie eases him back up and is looking right in the face when he's hit the right temple by a shot fired from the triple underpass and the picket fence where there's an above ground sewer opening. And Frank Sturgis, who may have been the best marksman in the world at the time, and I believe was representing the CIA, fired that round. Sturgis would later be arrested by a NYPD Gold Shield detective of my acquaintance, Jim Rothstein, in New York City, where he'd come to murder Marita Lorenz, who'd been a mistress of Adele, who traveled with some of the those who were involved in the assassination by automobile, but she left because she didn't want to have anything to do with it. To prevent her from testifying, he was going to kill her, but Rothstein intercepted him, stuck his gun in Sturgis's mouth while his partner stuck his gun up to his heart, took him into custody, and while he had him there, gave him the throwaway line, nice shooting. And Sturgis said he'd shot JFK because he had abandoned the brigade at the Bay of Pigs, which was untrue, but which the CIA found convenient to allow them to believe, and that he'd had a dalliance with a woman who was a spy for East Germany, which was 100% true, unknowingly, of course. I mean, this was information Edgar gave to LBJ to force his way under the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960, which was indispensable to the whole project to make Lyndon president of the United States by taking out Jack. And that was a big picture. That was a plan. So Jack eases him right up, and then Sturgis fires a shot, hits the right temple, and David now believes there may have been a second shot, which I believe then would have been fired by a guy representing Israel, whom I believe is still alive and lives in Toronto by the name of Clyde Porishaw, who was murdered hundreds of people by my sources. Hundreds of people. And he was in the area of the pergola. Only Domegard identified him there, and I agree. And I would say then it would have been Clyde who fired the additional shot that hit Jack in the head about simultaneous with the Frank Sturgis shot and blew his brains out the back of his head. One or the other was using a frangible bullet because it also blew open a skull flap just in front of his ear. That was about 3 inches in height, in crescent shape, but continue to be attached because of skin. So you can see it in when I discovered, I mean, recognizing they spent a lot of time covering up the fist-sized blowout to the back of the head in early frames of the film, I conjectured that they might have overlooked that it could be visible later on, and I found in frame 374 that you can actually see it. And this little pinkish extension, which was that skull flap, but it's kind of blue-gray. Remember, you know, we talk about gray matter. Well, that's because cerebral tissue has a grayish color. And when you compare the area that David Manning defined as area P for patch, how they patch the X-ray to conceal it, there's a very close proximity, with the exception that in the frames from the film, there's hair, still some hair overlapping into the wound. So it's not quite the same, but it's a very close approximation. so that the area that David defined on the X-ray as having been patched corresponds to the area of the blowout that you can actually see in frame 374, and where Larry Rivera has now discovered that Jackie was wearing white gloves outlined the defect in earlier frames. She provides a background against which you can see this very substantial defect. And where Charles Crenshaw, who was a physician who had been in trauma room number one when JFK's moribund body was brought in, and then 2 days later responsible for the care and treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, provided me with diagrams of both the blowout to the back of the head from the side and from the back, and of the small clean puncture wound to the throat before and after the tracheostomy incision. So we know, you know, how many times Jack was hit. That's the totality of it. Shot to the back first, shot to the throat second, shot to the back of the head with the Daltex third, shot to the right temple and side of head near simultaneous, altogether five shots. Where the one to the throat actually turns out, I believe, Bob Livingston got it exactly right. It was actually perhaps the fatal shot. Jack may very well have been dead at that point. Jackie, by the way, said that from the front he looked just fine, but that she had a terrible time holding his skull and brains together at the back of his head. And indeed, when you see her climbing out over the limousine, she's going out for a chunk of Jack's skull and brains, which she holds in her hand all the way to Parkland. And then after they pry his moribund body out of her arms, she composes herself and goes into trauma room number one, turns to the anesthesiologist, Pepper Jenkins, extends her hand and asks, will this help? The most poignant moment of the entire assassination, because, I mean, Jackie knew a lot about culture, art, music, theater, blah, blah. She didn't know anything about ballistics, wounds, brains, neurology. It's not like a Lego set you can put back together. And when they tried to revive Jack, but honestly, he was already dead, I'm convinced. They said no pulse when he first came, and someone said they thought they detected a heartbeat. I don't think there was any heartbeat. But you got a president of the United States, you're going to take heroic measures, you're going to try to save him. And they did the incision of the little tracheostomy and all that before they realized he had this massive blowout to the back of the head. It was when, look at this, one said, and they looked at this, and they knew there was just no point in it. He was already dead. You got half your brains blown out in Dealey Plaza, you are D-E-A-D. You're dead. Now, when Malcolm Kilduff, the acting press secretary, came out and announced the president was dead, he said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head and pointed to his right temple, attributing that finding to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. And as I've already observed, at the Parkland press conference, Malcolm Perry had performed that simple incision through the clean puncture wound of the throat, three times described it as a wound of entry during the Parkland press conference. Three times. Now, I started to explain how Arlen Specter obfuscated this when he was questioning Malcolm Perry before the Warren Commission or during its hearings. He asked him not what he observed and what he inferred from what he observed. He instead asked him a hypothetical question that had a trivial answer. He said, if we assume the bullet entered here at the base of the back of the neck. Well, there was no bullet that entered the base of the back of the neck. That bullet had only entered the back wound 5.5 inches below the collar of the shallow. That's the one where Sam Kinney found the bullet and took it inside and it became the magic bullet. If we assume, Arlen Specter says, and just think of this as all hypothetical, because that's what it was, a hypothetical question. If we assume the bullet enters here and pass through the neck without hitting any bony structures, which David Manning has shown to be impossible, but you're being asked to make that assumption, and came out here pointing to the front of the neck, would that mean this was a wound of accent? Well, Malcolm Perry knew it was a wound of entry, right? You know, he said so three times during the Parkland presidency. He saw this wound up close and personal. So how did he reply? And he was coached, no doubt. He said, well, yes, that is correct, but that he was not in the position to vouch for or verify the assumptions he'd been asked to make. Look at that. How brilliant is that? All inspectors asked him to make false assumptions about where the bullet entered, false assumption about a bullet passing through without hitting any bony structure, false assumption about a bullet coming out in the front of the neck, and you thereby convert an entry wound into an exit. Now, what happened that afternoon was actually historic because the mainstream media were actually being responsible and doing their job. They were reporting nonstop every detail, every report they had about what took place from the Parkland, from the police. Every report they could gather, what newsmen were able to find or ascertain. And what you got from, say, NBC, live coverage of the assassination is still available online from 1:30 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. You had Chet Huntley, who is one of the, you know, most, one part of what would become the most famous news team in American reporting history, Huntley Brinkley. I grew up with Huntley Brinkley, just as I did with Walter Cronkite. He was the most respected voice in America, Walter Cronkite. And everyone's heard the report from Dallas, three shots being fired. President Kennedy has been injured, and then is reporting that the president is dead. Well, yeah, Chet Huntley and a group of others on NBC, not equal in their competence, as Chet would show himself to be, but they were all reporting the reports. And what they got was they were reporting two wounds that day. They were reporting the small, clean puncture wound to the throat, and they were reporting the hit to the right temple that exited the back of the head and attributing that to Admiral George Berkeley over and over during the afternoon. They were reporting those two wounds. Both of which, of course, were fired from in front. So that as the day drags on, and later on, they start to trickle in these stories that they discovered who'd done it, Lee Oswald, who was arrested like an hour later. I mean, you know, it couldn't have been more blatant that this was a setup. Where the arrest report, which actually was timed and dated about 10 minutes before Lee Oswald was actually arrested, said this man shot and killed President John F. Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally, and then they added, and he shot and killed Officer J.D. Tippit. I mean, this is just blatant bullshit. This was a Dallas PD that appears to have been assigned the role to frame Lee Oswald, and they were very slovenly about it, very slovenly about it. So, when the reports start trickling in about the lone gunman on the sixth floor firing three shots from above and behind, Frank McGee, who is nobody's fool, says, you find it right on NBC, says, this is incongruous how can the man have been shot from in front, from behind. In other words, got these two wounds, they're reporting, shot to the throat, shot to the right forehead, and now you got the FBI and the Secret Service claiming all the shots came from above and behind, so he appropriately observes this is incongruous. This does not add up. It was absurd. And I believe all Americans who are glued to the TV, and this was the event that made television indispensable in the lives of every American family, knew subconsciously, if not consciously, when the Warren Commission came out and said there'd only been three shots fired from above and behind from the sixth floor of the book depository, that something was wrong. Now, just as in the case of Pfizer and the FDA wanted to lock up all the records about tests done before they released the vax, which is killing millions upon millions and is going to get worse. For 75 years. So, too, the Warren Commission wanted to have its documents and records locked up for 75 years. Why 75 years? Because that's the average lifespan of an American citizen. So they wanted all these records to be locked up for 75 years so no one who was alive at the time of the assassination would be in a position to show or report or be aware of how contradictory it was what they're now reporting after 75 years. I mean, just grotesque. That was the plan. Now, here's something else you want to know. The very day of the shooting, that evening, and this is what then they were reporting that bothered Frank McGee. The FBI and the Secret Service concluded there had been three and only three shots. That the first shot had hit JFK in the back, and he was hit in the back, and they were then identifying it properly. 5.5 inches below the collar, just the right of his spinal column, his shallow shot. John Connolly was hit in the back. John Connolly was hit in the back. Now, that shot appears to have been fired by Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman. It was firing from the west side of the book depository in the mistaken belief that this was Ralph Yarborough, a liberal Texas senator, whom Lyndon despised. In fact, there was a huge argument that morning between LBJ and JFK where Lyndon wanted to get Connolly, his buddy, his friend, his crony. He'd even been his campaign manager running against JFK for the nomination out of the vehicle. And Ralph Yarborough, the liberal Texas senator he despised in, but Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. And it was too late to get the word out to the shooters. So here was Mack Wallace firing at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that it was actually Ralph Yarborough. He shot him in the back, and as if I'm played, I think probably also a second time in the right wrist, actually, and wound up in the left thigh. And then the third shot was in the back of the head, killing him. And that was the shot fired from the Daltex, where he slumped forward, you know, fired after the limousine was brought to a halt. But now you begin to see how massively they had to edit the film. They had to get rid of all that limo stop and a whole lot of things happened. Bobby Hargis had been hit with all that debris when JFK's brains were blown out. Parked his bike, ran between the two vehicles up to the grassy knoll from which he believed the shot had been fired. Officer Douglas Jackson on the opposite side rode his motorbike up the grassy knoll until it fell over, then proceeded on foot. One or another was confronted with one of those forged Secret Service IDs that Chauncey Holt had prepared. Meanwhile, five agents dismounted from the Secret Service Cadillac, colloquially known as a Queen Mary, surrounded the presidential. One took a chunk of skull from the little boy and threw it in the back seat, which may very well have been this triangular chunk of skull that was blown out, known as the Harbor Fragment. And then they got back in the vehicle and sped off. Now, lots of witnesses to the limo stop. The question has always been its duration. Well, Larry Rivera, who's done completely brilliant work in this area as well as others, recovered the Fred Newcomb interviews with the four motorcycle patrolmen and their supervisor, Stavis Ellis, and all four of the motorcycle patrolmen confirmed the limo stop and reconstructed these activities, these events. So we know exactly what happened, and I've been unable to reconcile all of that activity with a limo stop of less than 20 seconds. And if you got a camera that's running at about 20 seconds, 20 frames a second, that's 400 frames. We also know there's a big gap, you know, turning from Houston onto Elm. The motorcade approaches Houston, and boom, all of a sudden there you see the limousine approaching the Stemmons Freeway sign. Now, Abraham Zapruder himself said He filmed continuously once that motorcade came into view on Houston until it disappeared under the Triple Underpass. What we actually have in the extant version is anomalous in the following way. If Zapruder had a handheld camera, as his camera was, following the limo, then it would stay relatively in the center of motion. But actually, the limo sort of disappears to the bottom, which is consistent with a filming of a camera on a tripod in the pergola. Because the pergola is a tripod mounted, isn't taking into account that 11-degree slant. So the limousine starts to disappear at the bottom. What they did, therefore, was to edit together footage from more than one source. I think that tripod camera, but they also had footage from when the pilot card passed by, because one of the anomalies of the Zapruder is the passenger, all the bystanders are looking motionless. They're not responding to the presence of Jack and Jackie. And that's very damn peculiar, because everywhere else in the motorcade, people are just being overjoyed and delirious at seeing Jack and Jackie. And by the way, that's one more way we know how the Secret Service set him up, because the presidential limousine was out in front to make it easier for the shooters to spot the target. Jackie was given a huge bouquet of red roses to identify where it was, and also to remind them she was off limits. Jackie was not to be harmed. I'll be right back.
Like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building. Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, they had to do a lot of editing, and in fact, they merged the two shots, the shot that hit him in the back of the head with a shot from the right front, or perhaps simultaneous with a shot from the side, merging three shots, if perhaps, certainly at least two, which was ironically the best part of Josiah Thompson's book, Success in Dallas. He had very methodical measurements of how the only motion that remains from the back of the head shot is between frames 312 and 313. You have forward motion. And then you have this violent back and to the left. Well, a violent back and to the left did not actually occur in Dealey Plaza. That was a artifact from removing too many frames. So that those who have seen what appears to be the unedited film said, yes, yes. He's hit in the back of the head, and he slumps forward, jackies him back up. Then he's hit in that right temple, and possibly also from the side, and he slumps to the left. He just slumps to the left. Clint Hill, by the way, is the very first to see the blowout to the back of the head up close and personal. Because he's got Jack's lying down, he's lying over him. And he describes this fist-sized gaping wound. It even occurs in a book called The Kennedy Detail about the Dallas performance of the Secret Service. Astonishing, because it contradicts the official narrative completely to have a blowout at the back of the head. That's why they concealed. In fact, this is one of the most gruesome aspects. Not only did they enlarge the wound of the throat at Bethesda to make it look more like a wound of exit, where Commander Humes, who was in charge of the autopsy, actually called Bob Livingston and asked him what would it look like if it had been a wound of exit instead of a wound of entry, and Bob described him. And I think using that description, he messed with it to make it look more like a wound of exit. But get this. He actually took a cranial saw to the skull of JFK to enlarge that fist-sized blowout so it was represent a whole back, missing back of his head, well upward to the top of the head. So it could be presented as though something that could have been an effect of a shot fired from above and behind if JFK had been leaning well forward. But he did it in front of two witnesses, one of whom was Thomas Evan Robinson, who was the guy who would embalm him, prepare him for a formal state funeral. And when the Assassination Records Review Board came to depose, you know, him, they asked him about these dotted lines on a diagram of the skull, and he said, oh, no, the doctors did that, and he explained how Humes had taken this cranial saw. Well, believe it or not, the House Select Committee, when it reinvestigated the case in 77-78 and issued his final report in 1979, reconstituted the whole back of the head. So now it's all completely intact. And they move that wound from the external occipital protuberance right to the crown of the head. They move it up 4 inches. I mean, that's a staggering discrepancy in a professional, competent physicians who are doing an autopsy. That's unheard of all by itself. But worse, the reconstruction of the back of the head doesn't even make allowance for a Harper fragment. We have this very substantial chunk of skull, triangular, missing from the back of the head. But yet, according to the CA, it's all intact. It's all intact. I mean, it's just insulting beyond belief. They do have that little skull flap shown, by the way. So it's just disgusting. And then, as I say, when they discovered that the one shot, they had the three-shot scenario, shot to the back of Jack, shot to the back of Connolly, shot to the back of Jack's head, that they thought that was a neat package. But then when it turned out that shot had missed and injured James Tague, they had to subtract one because they were locked into three. Now they only had two. So they had moved the back wound back up to make it a back of the neck wound so they could have a trajectory to come out the throat to turn it into an exit from an entry wound. That get rid of the shot from in front. And then, of course, you know, they never do address the fact that we had widely reported on radio and television two wounds that contradict the official account. So it's been bullshit shoved down our throat by the American media and the American government to conceal the death of the 35th president of the United States. It's just astounding. And I think once you get you grasp the enormity of that deception, and you realize how, wow, maybe 9/11 wasn't such a stretch, or Sandy Hook. I'm telling you, when you control the media, you see, Henry Kissinger made this very telling point way back when. He said, the facts don't matter. Only perceptions. Wow. And that's what the government and the media and the propagandists have run with ever since. Facts don't matter, only perceptions. So they're marketing you the perception they want you to accept. And it's all happy horse shit. It's all ridiculous beyond belief. Lyndon was in a unique position to bring the key parties together, by the way, where... If you get a chance to pick up a book by Noel Twyman called Bloody Treason. Noel's a retired engineer who really published a book in 1997. It's one of the most important books ever published on the assassination. And he saw that the most perfect combination with the greatest probability of success brought together the CIA with the military, the Secret Service, the Mafia, LBJ, and Hoover. With LBJ in the group, Hoover could have been relied upon to fall in line because the Mafia having compromised him. Now, here's the deal. Right up to the Joe Valachi hearings, the J. Edgar Hoover didn't even acknowledge the existence of organized crime. How could that happen? Well, just as Hoover had sex dossiers on the members of Congress, the mob had a sex dossier on Hoover, showing him in what we can describe as compromising positions with his close personal aide, Clyde Tolson. Edgar even liked to wear women's dresses. So the mob had a handle on Edgar, just as Edgar had handles on Congress. And wouldn't even acknowledge the existence of organized crime until after the Valachi hearings, when it took place and was described in such detail that it was no longer possible politically to deny it. Well, Hoover was providing LBJ with key information. Here are some of the scenarios that Noel Twyman outlines. All the Mafia, if you assume the Mafia was the head, all the Mafia had to do was get the CIA involved and have the CIA recruit the Secret Service and LBJ, and it would have had a perfect conspiracy. All LBJ had to do was recruit the CIA, would use the Mafia as needed in the Secret Service, and he had a perfect conspiracy. Hoover would fall in line after the fact, confronted by LBJ and the Mafia with the blackmail material they had on him already. In this scenario, the right-wing extremists, if involved at all, would provide the money. Well, he's basically got him right there. If you read the books by Phil Nelson and then books by Madeline Duncan Brown, a mistress of Lyndon, by Billy Saul Estes, who was a confederate of Lyndon, by Barb McClellan, who worked at the law firm where they helped to plan the assassination, E. Howard Hutt's description of the chain of command, all the pieces fall into place. Roger Stone has a book about on LBJ, you know, for having shot JFK, really being responsible. Obviously, he wasn't one of the actual gunmen because he was in his vehicle in the motorcade. But he was ducking down early. He knew everything was going on, by the way. He was listening to a report on a Secret Service. They had two lines, and he was listening on one, which was the command and control for the assassination taking place. So here's where it all began. It was in Los Angeles in 1960. JFK beat LBJ for the nomination of the Democratic Party. And Jack invited Stuart Symington of Missouri to be his running mate, but he gave Symington overnight to think about it. Meanwhile, and there's lots of precedents for this, Bobby went by the Johnson suite to extend a pro forma invitation to run with Jack in the vice presidential slot. This is just routine. It's a gesture, a political gesture. Never expecting he'd have the least interest, because it would have entailed giving up his very powerful position as a majority leader of the United States Senate, where he was a master manipulator. Lyndon had the ability of virtually sizing up a man upon meeting him. He could discern his weaknesses and his strengths. I mean, he was uncanny. You got to read the first few chapters of Phil Nelson's fantastic book, LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination. You won't have any doubt. You'll see the character persona, Lyndon Johnson. He was ruthless, narcissistic, unprincipled. He would countenance no opposition. But he could also be charming, seemingly affectionate, a good friend, an ally. I had a conversation with Madeline Duncan Brown when we were in Dallas, just the two of us together. And she was saying how John Connally had said that to describe Lyndon would require all the adjectives in the dictionary. And she didn't understand what that meant. And I explained to Madeline, with whom Lyndon began an affair in 1948, who bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950, and who was at a ratification meeting at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before the assassination, when Lyndon showed up late unexpectedly, and heavy hitters, including John J. McCloy, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, disappeared into a boardroom for about 15 minutes. And when they came out, Lyndon strode over to her, and she told me she expected him to whisper sweet nothing in her ear, but in Teddy's holder in a hateful tone of voice, "You wouldn't be putting up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer after tomorrow. That wasn't a threat. That was a promise." He even called her the following day and repeated. They would have a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, on New Year's Eve, just a few weeks later, during which Madeline would confront him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. And Lyndon blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys decided that Jack had to be taken out. Well, here's the rest of the story. When Bobby goes by the Johnson Street just to make this gesture invitation, he is astonished because Lyndon jumps on it. He insists he must be on the ticket, and if not, he will reveal that JFK suffers from Addison's disease, which means he won't live a long, healthy life, that among his paramours was a spy for East Germany, which, as I mentioned before, is information got from Edgar. It was true, though Jack, I'm quite sure, had no idea she was a spy. He was being given these steroid shots that made him a bit hypersexual, but he wasn't much of a lover. Angie Dickinson, for example, said that her love affair with JFK was the greatest 14 seconds of her life. there's more and more about it. But, I mean, Jack wasn't really much in the romance department. And Lyndon added that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposal sent down from the White House would be dead on arrival, because in his position as a majority leader of the Senate, he'd block him up. Well, this was a real curveball. Jack and Bobby tried to figure a way out, but Lyndon had him boxed in, and he had to accede to his demands. When one of Lyndon Johnson's wealthy backers learned that Lyndon would be on the ticket with Jack, he burst into the Johnson suite, cursing and swearing. Since now Lyndon would help JFK become president of the United States, Bobby Baker, who was Lyndon's bag man, he took all kinds of graft and corruption in huge bags of money, okay, for Lyndon. Where, in fact, that very day, people forget, 22 November 1963, there was to be a vote in the United States Senate on the Bobby Baker scandal that was widely expected to tarnish Lyndon so badly he couldn't run with Jack again, but Jack had already decided he wasn't going to run with Lyndon. He told his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, that he was thinking of running with Terry Sanford of North Carolina, but would not be LBJ. So his political future was at an end. He was going to get Jack that day. If it weren't at Dealey Plaza, then they changed where he was going to speak to a venue that had all kinds of entries and exits that the Secret Service didn't like. And last but not least, plan C, if A and B failed, was to assassinate him on the Johnson Ranch where he was going to spend the night. Least desirable. But he had to be dead that day. So when this guy burst into the Johnson suite, cursing and swearing, Bobby took him into a bedroom and explained to him what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare in public that JFK would not live out his first term, and that he would die a violent death. In the course of events, Lyndon Johnson would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. Now, Billy Saul Esses, who was involved in all kinds of schemes, he has a book called A Texas Legend, meaning he himself, Billy Saul Esses, knew Cliff Carter, knew Mack Wallace. Mack, as I said, was Lyndon's personal hitman. He even killed one of Lyndon's own sisters because she talked too much. And he reports in his book how he had conversation with the two of them, and he sensed that they had both been deeply involved in the assassination, which, of course, is completely correct. We have Barr McClellan, who worked in a law office of a guy named Ed Clark, who was a Lyndon Johnson attorney, where much of the planning for the assassination also took place. Then we have E. Howard Hunt, who, while he's often mistaken for the third of the three tramps, who was actually Chauncey Marvin Holt, was in Dallas but wasn't an active player, who, when he thought he was on his deathbed, related to his son, St. John, whom I have met, that the chain of command went from Lyndon Johnson to Cord Meyer, who was then in charge of covert activities for the CIA, to David Atlee Phillips, who was in charge of Western Hemisphere, to William Harvey, who was in charge of assassination worldwide, to David Sanchez Morales for Dallas. David also appears to have had a role to play with regard to Bobby's death in L.A., but that's another story for another day. So the evidence implicating Lyndon is simply overwhelming. There's a recent Rear Guard Action with a book by David Talbot, where he and his running mate, who also has a blog, had actually tried to muck up when there was serious research going on to try to figure out about David Sanchez Morales and his role here. They went down and talked about having a lot of money, very open, what they wanted to know, so everyone would clam up, shut up, completely. Talbot has a book where he basically is seeking to blame it on Alan Dulles. Don't let yourself be played. Alan Dulles was not a good guy. Alan Dulles didn't like the Kennedys. Alan Dulles, I'm sure, had something to do with it, but this was all the way with LBJ. This was Lyndon's brainchild. Carried it off with aplomb. With Edgar, was able to seal it all up. When they transferred the evidence from Dallas to Washington, they switched the weapon that had been found in the Daltex, the Mannlicher Carcano, for the Mannlicher Carcano that Nestor Tony Escadro had used in the Daltex. And remember, they already had that bullet, which would be the magic bullet, which they was fired from that weapon. Originally in the Daltex, by the way, but they found a Mauser, a German Mauser, which actually would have been a good choice for a sniper weapon. But Lee Oswald was never trained to use a bolt-action weapon. He was never trained to use a telescopic sight. He was never trained to fire on moving a target in a movie that was moving. But he also was in the doorway of the book depository when the motorcade passed by. So the whole thing is a monstrous pile of bullshit. My latest book, my fourth, called JFK, Who, How, and Why, Solving the World's Greatest Murder Mystery, is available from Moonrock Books and goes through everything I've been reporting to you here. I think virtually without exception, with much more evidence, of course, than I could induce over the radio, giving verbal depictions. Let me return to one other question that has haunted some. They think Jackie had something to do with the assassination. Jackie, by the way, married Aristotle Onassis because she felt he could provide her with the kind of security that Jack, ironically, had been unable to provide. The terms of their marriage even included how often Aristotle could have intercourse with Jackie. I mean, it was that specific. But Jackie loved Jack. The idea that she shot Jack, and people seem to think it was some sort of derringer that was in this dog-like. It was actually a sock puppet. Let's see, for some character on TV was given by one of the bystanders. It was a gun was supposed to be in that. Well, no, 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 no. And there's no wound for Jackie to have shot. Why would she have shot him? She loved Jack. She truly did. Even if she was tolerant of his escapades. And sophisticated women in that era, you know, especially related to Kennedy's, understood that they would have dalliances, but that they were not meaningful. So Jackie's supposed to have shot him with a derringer? Well, where's the bullet hole? Where did it go? Where's the entry wound? Where's the exit wound? We know he had a wound in the back. We got the shirt, the jacket, we got diagrams. I gave a lecture about this at Cambridge University, published in an international journal called Reasoning About Assassination. You can download it for yourself. The shot in the back. We know where it was. If we know anything, we know where Jack was shot in the back. The shot in the throat. Virtually, we know as much. We got the Parkland press conference. We got the windshield. The bullet went through. We got blah, blah, blah. We got Bob Livingston report. There are some today who, to my dismay, want to deny because they've got some pet theory up their sleeve they want to promote. Just ridiculous. Bob Livingston resolved these issues. Now, I don't mind going back and reviewing the bidding. We can always do that. But not at the cost of discounting all the well-established facts of the matter. Then we have the multiple shots to the head, the one to the back of the head, the one to the right temple, and to the side of the head, the right side of the head. So where was Jackie's shot? Where did she shoot Jack? I gotta say, I was dismayed. Tucker, you've heard me recommend Tucker repeatedly. Last night, he had someone on to talk about JFK, and who did they bring in? Gerald Posner, P-O-S-N-E-R. Published a book called Case Closed. That's just a kind of a child version of the Warren Commission report. I mean, it's ridiculous. Even has a diagram of the magic bullet that is inconsistent with the facts of the matter. Remember, it wasn't even anatomically possible. So, to me, this was a major confirmation of my belief that Tucker is wet behind the ears. He does not understand conspiracies, how frequently they occur, but shocking to me, even in relation to JFK, so far as I can tell. Even Tucker Carlson still thinks JFK, he believes that JFK was shot by Lee Oswald with three. Yeah, I mean, this is just ridiculous, and I'm at a loss as to what to do about it. I've sought to reach out to Tucker before about matters where he was mistaken or grossly unfamiliar with the evidence, such as Sandy Hook, or even my lawsuit before the Supreme Court. But to this point in time, I've seen no evidence or indication. By the way, I am back on Twitter, at Jim Fetzer. I'd welcome your following me. I'd be delighted. Send questions. I can respond. At Jim Fetzer, I think Elon Musk has done a wonderful thing. And when he put me back on, others who are pushing for Alex said, look, you put Fetzer on and he's got this book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. Why not Alex? I say Alex, too. Bring him on. Thank you all. Have a wonderful, wonderful day. We'll talk to you on Friday.
Recording stop.
Thank you for listening to Revolution.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and